given them. They were suspicious of abstraction and liked asking questions, which is why at every turn in our early history, theory yielded to fact and necessity. A rejection of absolutism in all its forms may sometimes slip into moral relativism or even nihilism, an erosion of values that hold society together. But for most of our history, it has encouraged the very process of information gathering, analysis, argument, and persuasion that allows us to make better, if not perfect, choices. Not only about the means to our ends, but also the ends themselves. The constitutional framework has allowed us to continually test out our ideals, our vision, and our values against the realities of a common life, ensuring that they're poked, prodded, and sifted through, so that over time they may be refined or discarded or replaced by new ideals, sharper visions, deeper values. Indeed, it is that process, according to Madison, that brought about the Constitution itself, a convention in which no man felt himself obliged to retain his opinions any longer than he was satisfied of their propriety and truth, and was open to the force of argument. In sum, the Constitution envisions a roadmap by which we marry passion to reason, the ideal of individual freedom to the demands of community. And the amazing thing is that it's worked. Through the early days of the Union, through depressions and World War, through the multiple transformations of the economy and Western expansion, and the arrival of millions of immigrants to our shores, our democracy has not only survived, but has thrived. Only once has the conversation broken down, and that was over the one subject the founders refused to talk about. The Declaration of Independence may have been, in the words of historian Joseph Ellis, a transformative moment in world history, when all laws and human relationships dependent on coercion would be swept away forever. But that spirit of liberty did not extend, in the minds of the founders, to the slaves that worked their fields, made their beds, and nursed their children. The Constitution's exquisite machinery would secure the rights of citizens, those deemed members of America's political community, but it provided no protection to those outside the constitutional circle, the Native Americans whose treaties proved worthless before the court of the conqueror, or the black man, Dred Scott, who would walk into the Supreme Court a free man and leave a slave. Democratic deliberation might have been sufficient to expand the franchise to white men without property, and eventually women. Reason and argument and American pragmatism might have eased the economic growing pains of a great nation and helped lessen religious and class tensions that would plague other nations. But deliberation alone could not provide the slave his freedom or cleanse America of its original sin. In the end, it was the sword that would sever his chains. What does this say about our democracy? There's a school of thought that sees the Founding Fathers only as hypocrites, and the Constitution only as a betrayal of the grand ideals set forth by the Declaration of Independence, that agrees with early abolitionists that the great compromise between North and South was a pact with the devil. Others, representing the safer, more conventional wisdom, will insist that all the constitutional compromise on slavery were necessary, if unfortunate requirements, for the formation of the Union, that in their silence the founders only sought to postpone what they were certain would be slavery's ultimate demise, that this single lapse cannot detract from the genius of the Constitution, which permitted the space for abolitionists to rally and the debate to proceed, and that provided the framework by which, after the Civil War had been fought, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments could be passed and the Union finally perfected. How can I, an American with the blood of Africa coursing through my veins, choose sides in such a dispute? I can't. I love America too much, am too invested in what this country has become, too committed to its institutions, its beauty, and even its ugliness, to focus entirely on the circumstances of its birth. But neither can I brush aside the magnitude of the injustice done, or erase the ghosts of generations past, or ignore the open wound, the aching spirit, which ails this country still. I'm left then with Lincoln, who, like no man before or since, understood both the deliberative function of our democracy and the limits of such deliberation. We remember him for the firmness and depth of his convictions, his unyielding opposition to slavery, and his determination that a house divided could not stand. But his presidency was guided by a practicality that would distress us today, a practicality that led him to test various bargains with the South in order to maintain the Union without war, to appoint and discard general after general, strategy after strategy, once war broke out, to stretch the Constitution to the breaking point in order to see the war through to a successful conclusion. I like to believe that for Lincoln it was never a matter of abandoning conviction for the sake of expediency. Rather, it was a matter of maintaining within himself the balance between two contradictory ideas, that we must talk and reach for common understandings, precisely because all of us are imperfect and can never act with the certainty that God is on our side. And yet at times we must act nonetheless, as if we are certain, protected from error only by providence. The blood of slaves reminds us that our pragmatism can sometimes be moral cowardice. Lincoln and those buried at Gettysburg remind us that we should only pursue our own absolute truths if we accept that there may be a terrible price to pay. Such late-night meditations proved unnecessary in my immediate decision about George W. Bush's nominees to the Federal Court of Appeals. In the end, the crisis in the Senate was averted, or at least postponed. 7 Democratic senators agreed not to filibuster all but 2 of Bush's most controversial nominees, and to preserve their support of a filibuster only in more extraordinary circumstances. In exchange, 7 Republicans agreed to vote against a nuclear option that would permanently eliminate the filibuster, again with the caveat that they could change their minds in the event of extraordinary circumstances. No one was more ecstatic with this turn of events than Senator Byrd. The day the deal was announced, he walked triumphantly down the halls of the Capitol with Republican John Warner of Virginia, the younger members trailing behind the old lions. "We have kept the Republic," Senator Byrd announced to a pack of reporters, and I smiled to myself, thinking back to the visit that the two of us had finally been able to arrange a few months earlier. It was in Senator Byrd's hideaway on the first floor of the Capitol, tucked alongside a series of small, beautifully painted rooms where Senate committees once regularly met. His secretary had led me into his private office, which was filled with books and what looked to be aging manuscripts, the walls lined with old photographs and campaign memorabilia. Senator Byrd asked me if it would be all right if we took a few photographs together, and we shook hands and smiled for the photographer who was present. After the secretary and the photographer had left, we sat down in a pair of well-worn chairs. Eventually, I asked him what advice he would give me as a new member of the Senate. "Learn the rules," he said, nodding to himself. "Not just the rules, but the precedents as well." He pointed to a series of thick binders behind him, each one affixed with a handwritten label. "Not many people bother to learn them these days. Everything is so rushed, so many demands on a senator's time. But these rules unlock the power of the Senate. They're the keys to the kingdom." We spoke about the Senate's past, the presidents he had known, the bills he had managed. He told me I would do well in the Senate, but I shouldn't be in too much of a rush. So many senators today became fixated on the White House, not understanding that in the constitutional design, it was the Senate that was supreme, the heart and soul of the Republic. "So few people read the Constitution today," Senator Byrd said, pulling out his copy from his breast pocket. "I've always said this document and the Holy Bible, they've been all the guidance I need." Before I left, he insisted that his secretary bring in a set of his Senate histories for me to have. As he slowly set the beautifully bound books on the table and searched for a pen, I told him how remarkable it was he had found the time to write. "Oh, I've been very fortunate," he said, nodding to himself. "Much to be thankful for. There's not much I would do over." Suddenly he paused and looked squarely into my eyes. "I have only one regret, you know. The foolishness of youth." We sat there for a moment, considering the gap of years and experience between us. "We all have regrets, Senator," I said finally. "We just ask that in the end, God's grace shines upon us." He studied my face for a moment, then nodded with the slightest of smiles and flipped open the cover of one of the books. God's grace. Yes, indeed. Let me sign these for you then, he said. And taking one hand to steady the other, he slowly scratched his name on the gift. Chapter 4. Politics. One of my favorite tasks of being a senator is hosting town hall meetings. I held 39 of them my first year in the Senate, all across Illinois, in tiny rural towns like Anna, in prosperous suburbs like Naperville, in black churches on the south side, and a college in Rock Island. There's not a lot of fanfare involved. My staff will call up the local high school, library, or community college to see if they're willing to host the event. A week or so in advance, we advertise in the town newspaper, in church bulletins, and on the local radio station. On the day of the meeting, I'll show up a half hour early to chat with town leaders and we'll discuss local issues, perhaps a road in need of repaving or plans for a new senior center. After taking a few photographs, we enter the hall where the crowd is waiting. I shake hands on my way to the stage, which is usually bare except for a podium, a microphone, a bottle of water, and an American flag posted in its stand. And then, for the next hour or so, I answer to the people who sent me to Washington. Attendance varies at these meetings. We've had as few as 50 people turn out, as many as 2,000. But however many people show up, I'm grateful to see them. They're a cross-section of the counties we visit, Republican and Democrat, old and young, fat and skinny, truck drivers, college professors, stay-at-home moms, veterans, school teachers, insurance agents, CPAs, secretaries, doctors, and social workers. They are generally polite and attentive, even when they disagree with me or one another. They ask me about prescription drugs, the deficit, human rights in Burma, ethanol, bird flu, school funding, and the space program. And as I look out over the crowd, I somehow feel encouraged. My time with them is like a dip in a cool stream. I feel cleansed afterwards, glad for the work I have chosen. At the end of the meeting, people will usually come up to shake hands, take pictures, or nudge their children forward to ask for an autograph. They slip things into my hand. Articles, business cards, handwritten notes, armed service medallions, small religious objects, good luck charms. And sometimes someone will grab my hand and tell me that they have great hopes for me, but that they're worried that Washington is going to change me, and I will end up just like all the rest of the people in power. Please stay who you are, they will tell me. Please don't disappoint us. It's an American tradition to attribute the problems with our politics to the quality of our politicians. At times, this is expressed in very specific terms. The president is a moron, or Congressman so-and-so is a bum. Sometimes a broader indictment is issued, as in, they're all in the pocket of the special interests. Most voters conclude that everyone in Washington is just playing politics, meaning that votes or positions are taken contrary to conscience, that they are based on campaign contributions or the polls or loyalty to party, rather than on trying to do what's right. Often, the fiercest criticism is reserved for the politician from one's own ranks, the Democrat who doesn't stand for anything, or the Republican in name only. All of which leads to the conclusion that if we want anything to change in Washington, we'll need to throw the rascals out. And yet year after year, we keep the rascals right where they are, with the re-election rate for House members hovering around 96%. Political scientists can give you a number of reasons for this phenomenon, but one that is rarely mentioned helps explain why polls consistently show voters hating Congress but liking their congressman. Hard as it may be to believe, most politicians are pretty likable folks. Certainly I found this to be true of my Senate colleagues. One-on-one, they made for wonderful company. I'd be hard-pressed to name better storytellers than Ted Kennedy or Trent Lott, or sharper wits than Kent Conrad or Richard Shelby, or warmer individuals than Debbie Stabenow or Mel Martinez. As a rule, they proved to be intelligent, thoughtful, and hard-working people, willing to devote long hours and attention to the issues affecting their states. I was usually struck by their basic sincerity, their desire to get things right and leave the country better and stronger, their desire to represent their constituents and their values as faithfully as circumstances would allow. So what happened to make these men and women appear as the grim, uncompromising, insincere, and occasionally mean characters that populate our nightly news. What was it about the process that prevented reasonable, conscientious people from doing the nation's business? The longer I served in Washington, the more I saw friends studying my face for signs of a change, probing me for a newfound pomposity, searching for hints of argumentativeness or guardedness. I began examining myself in the same way. I began to see certain characteristics that I held in common with my new colleagues, and I wondered what might prevent my own transformation into the stock politician of bad TV movies. One place to start my inquiry was to understand the nature of ambition, for in this regard, at least, senators are different. Few people end up being United States senators by accident. At a minimum, it requires a certain megalomania, a belief that of all the gifted people in your state, you are somehow uniquely qualified to speak on their behalf, a belief sufficiently strong that you are willing to endure the sometimes uplifting, occasionally harrowing, but always slightly ridiculous process we call campaigns. Moreover, ambition alone is not enough. Whatever the tangle of motives, both sacred and profane, that pushes toward the goal of becoming a senator, those who succeed must exhibit an almost fanatical single-mindedness, often disregarding their health, relationships, mental balance, and dignity. Neither ambition nor single-mindedness fully accounts for the behavior of politicians, however. There's a companion emotion, perhaps more pervasive and certainly more destructive, an emotion that, after the giddiness of your official announcement as a candidate, rapidly locks you in its grip and doesn't release you until after Election Day. That emotion is fear, not just fear of losing, although that is bad enough, but fear of total, complete humiliation. I still burn, for example, with the thought of my one loss in politics, a drubbing in 2000, at the hands of incumbent Democratic Congressman Bobby Rush. I'm not suggesting the politicians are unique in suffering such disappointments. It's that, unlike most people who have the luxury of licking their wounds privately, the politician's loss is on public display. They're the sort of feelings that most people haven't experienced since high school, when the girl you've been pining over dismisses you with a joke in front of her friends, or you miss a pair of free throws with a big game on the line, the kinds of feelings that most adults wisely organize their lives to avoid. Most of the other sins of politics are derivative of this larger sin, the need to win, but also the need not to lose. Certainly that's what the money chase is all about. There was a time before campaign finance laws and snooping reporters when money shaped politics through outright bribery, when a politician could treat his campaign fund as his personal bank account and accept fancy junkets, when big honoraria from those who sought influence were commonplace, and the shape of legislation went to the highest bidder. More often, though, that's not the way money influences politics. Few lobbyists proffer an explicit quid pro quo to elected officials. They don't have to. Their influence comes simply from having more access to those officials than the average voter, having better information than the average voter, and having more staying power when it comes to promoting an obscure provision in the tax code that means billions for their clients and that nobody else cares about. As for most politicians, money isn't about getting rich. In the Senate, at least, most members are already rich. It's about maintaining status and power. It's about scaring off challengers and fighting off the fear. Money can't guarantee victory. It can't buy passion, charisma, or the ability to tell a story. But without money, and the television ads that consume all the money, you are pretty much guaranteed to lose. The amounts of money involved are breathtaking, particularly in big state races with multiple media markets. While in the state legislature, I never needed to spend more than $100,000 on a race. In fact, I developed a reputation for being something of a stick in the mud when it came to fundraising, co-authoring the first campaign finance legislation to pass in 25 years, refusing meals from lobbyists, rejecting checks from gaming and tobacco interests. When I decided to run for the U.S. Senate, my media consultant, David Axelrod, had to sit me down to explain the facts of life. Our campaign plan called for a bare-bones budget, a heavy reliance on grassroots support, and earned media, that is, an ability to make our own news. Still, David informed me that 1 week of television advertising in the Chicago media market would cost approximately $500,000. Covering the rest of the state for a week would run about $250,000. Figuring 4 weeks of TV and all the overhead and staff for a statewide campaign, the final budget for the primary would be around $5 million. Assuming I won the primary, I would then need to raise another $10 to $15 million for the general election. I went home that night and in neat columns proceeded to write down all the people I knew who might give me a contribution. Next to their names, I wrote down the maximum amounts that I would feel comfortable asking them for. My grand total came to $500,000. Absent great personal wealth, there's basically one way of raising the kinds of money involved in a U.S. Senate race. You have to ask rich people for it. In the first 3 months of my campaign, I would shut myself in a room with my fundraising assistant and cold call previous Democratic donors. It was not fun. Sometimes people would hang up on me. More often, their secretary would take a message, and I wouldn't get a return call, and I would call back two or three times until I either gave up or the person I was calling answered and gave me the courtesy of a person-to-person rejection. I started engaging in elaborate games of avoidance during call time. Frequent bathroom breaks, extended coffee runs, suggestions to my policy staff that we fine-tune that education speech for the third or fourth time. At the end of 3 months, our campaign had raised just $250,000, well below the threshold of what it would take to be credible. To make matters worse, my race featured what many politicians consider their worst nightmare, a self-financing candidate with bottomless pockets. His name was Blair Hull, and he had sold his financial trading business to Goldman Sachs a few years earlier for $531 million. Undoubtedly, he had a genuine, if undefined, desire to serve, and by all accounts, he was a brilliant man. But on the campaign trail, he was almost painfully shy, with the quirky, inward manner of someone who's spent most of his life alone in front of a computer screen. All of which made it easy to write off Mr. Hull as an opponent. Until one morning in April or May, when I pulled out of the circular driveway of my condo complex on the way to the office and was greeted by row upon row of large red, white, and blue lawn signs marching up and down the block. "Blair Hull for U.S. Senate," the signs read. And for the next 5 miles, I saw them on every street and along every major thoroughfare, in every direction and in every nook and cranny, in barbershop windows and posted on abandoned buildings, in front of bus stops and behind grocery store counters. Hull signs everywhere, dotting the landscape like daisies in spring. We began to read about certain neighborhood leaders in the black community who had suddenly decided that Mr. Hull was a champion of the inner city. Certain downstate leaders who extolled Mr. Hull's support of the family farm. And then the television ads hit. 6 months out and ubiquitous until election day. On every station, around the state, around the clock. Blair Hull with seniors, Blair Hull with children, Blair Hull ready to take back Washington from the special interests. By January 2004, Mr. Hull had moved into first place in the polls, and my supporters began swamping me with calls, insisting that I had to do something. Telling me I had to get on TV immediately, or all would be lost. What could I do? I explained that unlike Mr. Hull, I practically had a negative net worth. Assuming the best case scenario, our campaign would have enough money for exactly 4 weeks of television ads. And given this fact, it probably didn't make sense for us to blow the entire campaign budget in August. Everybody need to be patient, I would tell supporters. Stay confident. Don't panic. Then I'd hang up the phone, look out the window, and happen to catch sight of the RV in which Hull tooled around the state. Big as an ocean liner, and reputedly just as well appointed, and I would wonder to myself if perhaps it was time to panic after all. In many ways, I was luckier than most candidates in such circumstances. For whatever reason, at some point my campaign began to generate that mysterious, elusive quality of momentum, of buzz. It became fashionable among wealthy donors to promote my cause, and small donors around the state began sending checks through the internet at a pace we had never anticipated. Mr. Hull still ended up outspending me by a factor of 6-1, but to his credit, although perhaps to his regret, he never ran a negative TV ad against me. My poll numbers stayed within shouting distance of his, and in the final weeks of the campaign, just as my own TV spot started running and my numbers began to surge, his campaign imploded when allegations surfaced that he had had some ugly run-ins with an ex-wife. So for me, at least, the lack of wealth or significant corporate support wasn't a barrier to victory. Still, I can't assume that the money chase didn't alter me in some ways. Certainly it eliminated any sense of shame I once had in asking strangers for large sums of money. By the end of the campaign, the banter and small talk that had once accompanied my solicitation calls were eliminated. I cut to the chase and tried not to take no for an answer. But I worry that there was also another change at work. Increasingly, I found myself spending time with people of means, trial lawyers and investment bankers, hedge fund managers and venture capitalists. As a rule, they were smart, interesting people, knowledgeable about public policy, liberal in their politics, expecting nothing more than a hearing of their opinions in exchange for their checks. But they reflected, almost uniformly, the perspectives of their class. The top 1% or so of the income scale that can afford to write a $2,000 check to a political candidate. I know that as a consequence of my fundraising, I became more like the wealthy donors I met, in the very particular sense that I spent more and more of my time above the fray, outside the world of immediate hunger, disappointments, fear, irrationality, and frequent hardship of the other 99% of the population, that is, the people that I'd entered public life to serve. And in one fashion or another, I suspect this is true for every senator. The longer you are a senator, the narrower the scope of your interactions. You may fight it with town hall meetings and listening tours and stops by the old neighborhood, but your schedule dictates that you move in a different orbit from most of the people you represent. And perhaps, as the next race approaches, a voice within tells you that you don't want to have to go through all the misery of raising all that money in small increments all over again. You realize that you no longer have the cachet you did as the upstart, the fresh face. You haven't changed Washington, and you've made a lot of people unhappy with difficult votes. The path of least resistance, of fundraisers organized by the special interests, the corporate PACs, and the top lobbying shops, starts looking awfully tempting, and if the opinions of these insiders don't quite jibe with those you once held, you learn to rationalize the changes as a matter of realism, of compromise, of learning the ropes. The problems of ordinary people, the voices of the Rust Belt town or the dwindling heartland, become a distant echo rather than a palpable reality. Abstractions to be managed rather than battles to be fought. There are other forces at work on a senator. As important as money is in campaigns, it's not just fundraising that puts a candidate over the top. If you want to win in politics, if you don't want to lose, then organized people can be just as important as cash, particularly in the low turnout primaries that, in the world of the gerrymandered political map and divided electorates, are often the most significant race a candidate faces. Few people these days have the time or inclination to volunteer on a political campaign, particularly since the day-to-day tasks of working a campaign generally involve licking envelopes and knocking on doors, not drafting speeches and thinking big thoughts. And so, if you are a candidate in need of political workers or voter lists, you go to where the people are already organized. For Democrats, this means the unions, the environmental groups, and the pro-choice groups. For Republicans, it means the religious right, local chambers of commerce, the NRA, and the anti-tax organizations. I've never been entirely comfortable with the term special interests. It lumps together ExxonMobil and bricklayers, the pharmaceutical lobby, and the parents of special ed kids. Most political scientists would probably disagree with me, but to my mind, there's a difference between a corporate lobby whose clout is based on money alone and a group of like-minded individuals, whether they be textile workers, gun aficionados, veterans, or family farmers, coming together to promote their interests. Between those who use their economic power to magnify their political influence far beyond what their numbers might justify, and those who are simply seeking to pool their votes to sway their representatives. The former subvert the very idea of democracy. The latter are its essence. The impact of interest groups on candidates for office is not always pretty. To maintain an active membership, keep the donations coming in, and be heard above the din, the groups that have an impact on politics aren't fashioned to promote the public interest. They aren't searching for the most thoughtful, well-qualified, or broad-minded candidate to support. Instead, they are focused on a narrow set of concerns: their pensions, their crop supports, their cause. Simply put, they have an axe to grind. And they want you, the elected official, to help them grind it. During my own primary campaign, for example, I must have filled out at least 50 questionnaires. None of them were subtle. Typically, they would contain a list of 10 or 12 questions, phrased along the following lines. If elected, will you solemnly pledge to repeal the Scrooge Law, which has resulted in widows and orphans being kicked to the curb? Time dictated that I fill out only those questionnaires sent by organizations that might actually endorse me. Given my voting record, the NRA and National Right to Life, for example, did not make the cut. So I could usually answer yes to most questions without any major discomfort. But every so often I would come across a question that gave me pause. I might agree with the union on the need to enforce labor and environmental standards in our trade laws. But did I believe that NAFTA should be repealed? I might agree that universal health care should be one of the nation's top priorities. But did it follow that a constitutional amendment was the best way to achieve that goal? I found myself hedging on such questions, writing in the margins, explaining the difficult policy choices involved. My staff would shake their heads. Get one answer wrong, they explained, and the endorsement, the workers, and the mailing list would all go to the other guy. Get them all right, I thought to myself, and you have just locked yourself into the pattern of reflexive, partisan jousting that you have promised to help end. Say one thing during the campaign, and do another thing once in office, and you're a typical two-faced politician. I lost some endorsements by not giving the right answer. A couple of times a group surprised us and gave me their endorsement despite a wrong answer. And then sometimes it didn't matter how you filled out your questionnaire. In addition to Mr. Hull, my most formidable opponent in the Democratic primary for U.S. Senate was the Illinois State Comptroller, Dan Hines, a fine man, an able public servant whose father, Tom Hines, happened to be a former state Senate president, Cook County assessor, ward committeeman, Democratic National Committee member, and one of the most well-connected political figures in the state. Before even entering the race, Dan had already sewn up the support of 85 of the 102 Democratic County chairmen in the state, the majority of my colleagues in the state legislature, and Mike Madigan, who served as both Speaker of the House and chairman of the Illinois Democratic Party. Scrolling down the list of endorsements on Dan's website was like watching the credits at the end of a movie. You left before it was finished. Despite all this, I held out hope for a few endorsements of my own, particularly those of organized labor. For 7 years, I had been their ally in the state legislature, sponsoring many of their bills and making their case on the floor. I knew that traditionally, the AFL-CIO endorsed those who had a strong record of voting on their behalf. But as the campaign got rolling, odd things began to happen. The Teamsters held their endorsement session in Chicago, on a day that I had to be in Springfield for a vote. They refused to reschedule, and Mr. Hines got their endorsement without them ever talking to me. Visiting a labor reception during the Illinois State Fair, we were told that no campaign signs would be allowed. When my staff and I arrived, we discovered the room plastered with Hines posters. I went over to my staff to tell them we would not be getting the AFL-CIO endorsement. Again, things worked out. The leaders of several of the largest service workers unions, the Illinois Federation of Teachers, SEIU, AFSCME, Unite HERE, broke ranks and chose to endorse me over Hines, support that proved critical in giving my campaign some semblance of weight. It was a risky move on their part. Had I lost, those unions might have paid a price in access, in support, in credibility with their members. So I owe those unions. When their leaders call, I do my best to call them back right away. I don't consider this corrupting in any way. I don't mind feeling obligated toward a bunch of home health care workers who clean bedpans every day for little more than the minimum wage, or towards teachers in some of the toughest schools in the country, many of whom have to dip into their own pockets at the beginning of every school year to buy crayons and books for their students. I got into politics to fight for these folks, and I am glad a union is around to remind me of their struggles. But I also understand that there will be times when these obligations collide with other obligations. The obligation to inner-city children who are unable to read, say, or the obligation to children not yet born, whom we are saddling with debt. Already there have been some strains. I've proposed experimenting with merit pay for teachers, for example, and have called for raising fuel efficiency standards despite opposition from my friends at the UAW. I like to tell myself that I will continue to weigh the issues on the merits. I hope that I can always go to my union friends and explain why my position makes sense, how it's consistent with both my values and their long-term interests. But I suspect that the union leaders won't always see it that way. There may be times when they see it as betrayal. They may alert their members that I've sold them out. I may get angry mail and angry phone calls. They may not endorse me the next time around. And perhaps if that happens to you enough times, and you almost lose a race because a critical constituency is mad at you, or you find yourself fending off a primary challenger who's calling you a traitor, you start to lose your stomach for confrontation. You ask yourself, just what does good conscience dictate exactly? That you avoid capture by special interests, or that you avoid dumping on your friends? The answer is not obvious. So you start voting as you would answer a questionnaire. You don't ponder your positions too deeply. You check the yes box, up and down the line. Politicians held captive by their big money contributors or succumbing to interest group pressures. This is a staple of modern political reporting, the storyline that weaves its way into just about every analysis of what's wrong with our democracy. But for the politician who is worried about keeping his seat, there is a third force that pushes and pulls at him, that shapes the nature of political debate, and defines the scope of what he feels he can and can't do, the positions he can and can't take. That force is the media. Simple math tells the tale. In the 39 town hall meetings I held during my first year in office, turnout at each meeting averaged 400 to 500 people, which means that I was able to meet with maybe 15 to 20,000 people. Should I sustain this pace for the remainder of my term, I will have had direct personal contact with maybe 95 to 100,000 of my constituents by the time Election Day rolls around. In contrast, a 3-minute story on the lowest-rated local news broadcast in the Chicago media market may reach 200,000 people. In other words, I, like every politician at the federal level, am almost entirely dependent on the media to reach my constituents. It is the filter through which my votes are interpreted, my statements analyzed, my beliefs examined. The media's influence on our politics comes in many forms. What gets the most attention these days is the growth of an unabashedly partisan press. Talk radio, Fox News, newspaper editorialists, the cable talk show circuit, and most recently the bloggers, all of them trading insults, accusations, gossip, and innuendo 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Still, it's the more sophisticated practitioners who can sting you, in part because they have more credibility with the general public, in part because the skill with which they can pounce on your words and make you seem like a jerk. In April 2005, for example, I appeared on the program to dedicate the new Lincoln Presidential Library in Springfield. It was a 5-minute speech in which I suggested that Lincoln's humanity, his imperfections, were the qualities that made him so compelling. In Lincoln's rise from poverty, I said in one part of my remarks, his self-study and ultimate mastery of language and of law, and his capacity to overcome personal loss and remain determined in the face of repeated defeat, in all of this we see a fundamental element of the American character, a belief that we can constantly remake ourselves to fit our larger dreams. A few months later, Time magazine asked if I would be interested in writing an essay for a special issue on Lincoln. I didn't have time to write something new, so I asked the magazine's editor if my speech would be acceptable. They said it was, but asked if I could personalize it a little bit more, say something about Lincoln's impact on my life. In between meetings, I dashed off a few changes. One of those changes was to the passage quoted above, which now read, "In Lincoln's rise from poverty, his ultimate mastery of language and law, his capacity to overcome personal loss and remain determined in the face of repeated defeat. In all this, Lincoln reminded me, not just of my own struggles." No sooner had the essay appeared when Peggy Noonan, former Reagan speechwriter and columnist for the Wall Street Journal, chimed in. Under the title, Conceit of Government, she wrote, "This week comes the previously careful Senator Barack Obama, flapping his wings in Time magazine and explaining that he's a lot like Abraham Lincoln, only sort of better." She went on to say, There is nothing wrong with Barack Obama's resume, but it is a log cabin free zone. So far, it is also a greatness free zone. If he keeps talking about himself like this, it always will be. Ouch. I was reminded of what my veteran colleagues already knew, that every statement I made would be subject to scrutiny, dissected by every manner of pundit, interpreted in ways over which I had no control, and combed through for a potential error, misstatement, omission, or contradiction that might be filed away by the opposition party and appear in an unpleasant TV ad somewhere down the road. In an environment in which a single ill-considered remark can generate more bad publicity than years of ill-considered policies, it should have come as no surprise to me that on Capitol Hill, jokes got screened, irony became suspect, spontaneity was frowned upon, and passion was considered downright dangerous. I started to wonder how long it took for a politician to internalize all this. How long before the committee of scribes and editors and censors took residence in your head? How long before even the candid moments became scripted, so that you choked up or expressed outrage only on cue? How long before you started sounding like a politician? There was another lesson to be learned. As soon as Ms. Noonan's column hit, it went racing across the internet, appeared in every right-wing website as proof of what an arrogant, shallow boob I was. Just the quote Ms. Noonan selected, and not the essay itself, generally made an appearance on these sites. In that sense, the episode hinted at a more subtle and corrosive aspect of modern media, how a particular narrative, repeated over and over again and hurled through cyberspace at the speed of light, eventually becomes a hard particle of reality, how political caricatures and nuggets of conventional wisdom lodge themselves in our brain without us ever taking the time to examine them. For example, it's hard to find any mention of Democrats these days that doesn't suggest we are weak and don't stand for anything. Republicans, on the other hand, are strong, if a little bit mean, and Bush is decisive no matter how often he changes his mind. A vote or speech by Hillary Clinton that runs against type is immediately labeled calculating. The same move by John McCain burnishes his maverick credentials. Of course, the PR machinery of politicians and their parties help feed these narratives. And over the last few election cycles at least, Republicans have been far better at such messaging than the Democrats have been. A cliche that, unfortunately for us Democrats, really is true. The spin works, though, precisely because the media itself is hospitable to spin. Every reporter in Washington is working under pressures imposed by editors and producers, who in turn are answering to publishers or network executives, who in turn are poring over last week's ratings or last year's circulation figures and trying to survive the growing preference for PlayStation and reality TV. To make the deadline, to maintain market share and feed the cable news beast, reporters start to move in packs, working off the same news releases, the same set pieces, the same stock figures. Meanwhile, for busy and therefore casual news consumers, a well-worn narrative is not entirely unwelcome. It makes few demands on our thought or time. It's quick and easy to digest. Accepting spin is easier on everybody. This element of convenience also helps explain why, even among the most scrupulous reporters, objectivity often means publishing the talking points of different sides of a debate without any perspective on which side might actually be right. A typical story might begin, "The White House today reported that despite the latest round of tax cuts, the deficit is projected to be cut in half by the year 2010. This lead will then be followed by a quote from a liberal analyst attacking the White House numbers and a conservative analyst defending the White House numbers. Is one analyst more credible than the other? Is there an independent analyst somewhere who might walk us through the numbers? Who knows? Rarely does the reporter have time for such details. The story is not really about the merits of the tax cut or the dangers of the deficit, but rather about the dispute between the parties. Indeed, part of what makes the juxtaposition of competing press releases so alluring to reporters is that it feeds that old journalistic standby, personal conflict. It's hard to deny that political civility has declined in the past decade and that the parties differ sharply on major policy issues. But at least some of the decline in civility arises from the fact that, from the press's perspective, Civility is boring. Your quote doesn't run if you say, "I see the other guy's point of view," or "the issue's really complicated." Go on the attack, though, and you can barely fight off the cameras. The spin, the amplification of conflict, the indiscriminate search for scandal and miscues. The cumulative impact of all this is to erode any agreed-upon standards for judging the truth. We have no authoritative figure, no Cronkite or Murrow, whom we all listen to and trust to sort out contradictory claims. Instead, the media is splintered into a thousand fragments, each with his own version of reality, each claiming the loyalty of a splintered nation. Depending on your viewing preferences, global climate change is or is not dangerously accelerating. The budget deficit is going down or going up. I understand that facts alone can't always settle our political disputes. Our views on abortion aren't determined by the science of fetal development, and our judgment on whether and when to pull troops out of Iraq must necessarily be based on probabilities. But sometimes there are more accurate and less accurate answers. Sometimes there are facts that cannot be spun, just as an argument about whether it's raining can usually be settled by stepping outside. The absence of even rough agreement on the facts puts every opinion on equal footing, and therefore eliminates the basis for thoughtful compromise. It rewards not those who are right, but those, like the White House press office, that can make their arguments most loudly, most frequently, most obstinately, and with the best backdrop. Today's politician understands this. He may not lie, but he understands that there's no great reward in store for those who speak the truth, particularly when truth may be complicated. The truth may cause consternation. The truth will be attacked. The media won't have the patience to sort out all the facts, and so the public may not know the difference between truth and falsehood. What comes to matter, then, is positioning. The statement on an issue that will avoid controversy or generate needed publicity. The stance that will fit both the image his press folks have constructed for him and one of the narrative boxes the media has created for politics in general. The politician may still, as a matter of personal integrity, insist on telling the truth as he sees it, but he does so knowing that whether he believes in his positions matters less than whether he looks like he believes. That straight talk counts less than whether it sounds straight on TV. From what I've observed, there are countless politicians who've crossed these hurdles and kept their integrity intact. Men and women who raise campaign contributions without being corrupted, garner support without being held captive by special interests, and manage the media without losing their sense of self. But there is one final hurdle that once you've settled in Washington, you cannot entirely avoid. One that is assured to make at least a sizable portion of your constituency think ill of you. And that is the thoroughly unsatisfactory nature of the legislative process. I don't know a single legislator who doesn't anguish on a regular basis on the votes he or she has to take. There are times when one feels a piece of legislation to be so obviously right that it merits little internal debate. John McCain's amendment prohibiting torture by the U.S. government comes to mind. At other times, a bill appears on the floor that is so blatantly one-sided or poorly designed that one wonders how the sponsor can maintain a straight face during the debate. But most of the time, legislation is a murky brew, the product of 100 compromises, large and small, a blend of legitimate policy aims, political grandstanding, jerry-rigged regulatory schemes, and old-fashioned pork barrels. Often, as I read through the bills coming to the floor my first few months in the Senate, I was confronted with the fact that the principled thing was less clear than I had originally thought, that either an aye vote or a nay vote would leave me with some trace of remorse. Should I vote for an energy bill that includes my provision to boost alternative fuel production and improves the status quo, but that's wholly inadequate to the task of lessening America's dependence on foreign oil? Should I vote against a change in the Clean Air Act that will weaken regulations in some areas, but strengthen regulation in others, and create a more predictable system for corporate compliance? What if the bill increases pollution, but funds clean coal technology that may bring jobs to an impoverished part of Illinois? Again and again, I find myself poring over the evidence, pro and con, as best I can in the limited time available. My staff will inform me that the mail and phone calls are evenly divided, and that interest groups on both sides are keeping score. No legislator, state or federal, is immune from such difficult moments, and they are always far worse for the party out of power. As a member of the majority, you have some input in any bill that's important to you before it hits the floor. You can talk to the committee chairman to include language that helps your constituents, or eliminate language that hurts them. You can even ask the majority leader, or the chief sponsor, to hold the bill until a compromise more to your liking is reached. If you're in the minority party, you have no such protection. You must vote, yes or no, on whatever bill comes up, with the knowledge that it is unlikely to be a compromise that either you or your supporters consider fair or just. In an era of indiscriminate log rolling and massive omnibus spending bills, you can also rest assured that no matter how many bad provisions there are in a bill, there will be something. Funding for body armor for our troops, say, or some modest increase in veterans benefits that makes the bill painful to oppose. Not surprisingly, there are activists who insist that Democratic senators stand fast against any Republican initiative these days, even those initiatives that have some merit, as a matter of principle. It's fair to say that none of these individuals have ever run for high public office as a Democrat in a predominantly Republican state, nor have they been a target of several $1 million worth of negative TV ads. What every senator understands is that while it's easy to make a vote on a complicated piece of legislation look evil and depraved in a 30-second television commercial, it's very hard to explain the wisdom of that same vote in less than 20 minutes. What every senator also knows is that during the course of a single term, he or she will have cast several thousand votes. That's a whole lot of potential explaining to do come election time. Of course, there are technical fixes to our democracy that might relieve some of this pressure on politicians, structural changes that would strengthen the link between voters and their representatives. Nonpartisan districting, same-day registration, and weekend elections would all increase the competitiveness of races and might spur more participation from the electorate. And the more the electorate is paying attention, the more integrity is rewarded. Public financing of campaigns, or free television and radio time, could drastically reduce the constant scrounging for money and the influence of special interests. Changes in the rules in the House and the Senate might empower legislators in the minority, increase transparency in the process, and encourage more probing reporting. But none of these changes can happen of their own accord. Each would require a change in attitude among those in power. Each would demand that individual politicians challenge the existing order, loosen their hold on incumbency, fight with their friends as well as their enemies on behalf of abstract ideas in which the public appears to have little interest. Each would require, from men and women, a willingness to risk what they already have. In the end, then, it still comes back to that quality that John F. Kennedy sought to define as he lay convalescing from surgery, mindful of his heroism in war, but perhaps pondering the more ambiguous challenges ahead, the quality of courage. In some ways, the longer you are in politics, the easier it should be to muster such courage, for there is a certain liberation that comes from realizing that no matter what you do, someone will be angry at you, that political attacks will come no matter how cautiously you vote, that judgment may be taken as cowardice, and courage itself may be seen as calculation. I find comfort in the fact that the longer I'm in politics, the less nourishing popularity becomes, that a striving for power and rank and fame seem to betray a poverty of ambition, and that I am answerable mainly to the steady gaze of my own conscience and my constituents. Chapter 5. Opportunity. One thing about being a U.S. Senator, you fly a lot. There are the flights back and forth from Washington at least once a week. There are the trips to other states to deliver a speech, raise money, or campaign for your colleagues. If you represent a big state like Illinois, there are flights upstate or downstate to attend town meetings or ribbon cuttings and to make sure that the folks don't think you've forgotten them. Most of the time I fly commercial and sit in coach, hoping for an aisle or window seat, and crossing my fingers that the guy in front of me doesn't want to recline. But there are times when, because I'm making multiple stops on a West Coast swing, say, or need to get to another city after the last commercial flight has left, I fly on a private jet. I hadn't been aware of this option at first, assuming the cost would be prohibitive. But during the campaign, my staff explained that under Senate rules, a senator or candidate could travel on someone else's jet and just pay the equivalent of a first-class airfare. After looking at my campaign schedule and thinking about all the time I would save, I decided to give private jets a try. It turns out that the flying experience is a good deal different on a private jet. Private jets depart from privately owned and managed terminals, with lounges that feature big soft couches and big screen TVs and old aviation photographs on the walls. The restrooms are generally empty and spotless, and have those mechanical shoeshine machines and mouthwash and mints in a bowl. There's no sense of hurriedness at these terminals. The plane is waiting for you if you're late, ready for you if you're early. A lot of times you can bypass the lounge altogether and drive your car straight onto the tarmac. Otherwise, the pilots will greet you in the terminal, take your bags, and walk you out to the plane. And the planes, well, they're nice. The first time I took such a flight, I was on a Citation 10, a sleek, compact, shiny machine with wood paneling and leather seats that you could pull together to make a bed anytime you decided you wanted a nap. A shrimp salad and cheese plate occupied the seat behind me. Up front, the minibar was fully stocked. The pilots hung up my coat, offered me my choice of newspapers, and asked me if I was comfortable. I was. Then the plane took off, its Rolls-Royce engines gripping the air the way a well-made sports car grips the road. Shooting through the clouds, I turned on the small TV monitor in front of my seat. A map of the United States appeared, with the image of our plane tracking west, along with our speed, our altitude, our time to destination, and the temperature outside. At 40,000 feet, the plane leveled off, and I looked down at the curving horizon and the scattered clouds, the geography of the earth laid out before me. First the flat checkerboard fields of western Illinois, then the Python curves of the Mississippi, then more farmland and ranchland, and eventually the jagged Rockies, still snow-peaked, until the sun went down and the orange sky narrowed to a thin red line that was finally consumed by night and stars and moon. I could see how people might get used to this. I took a trip that made me think about what was happening with the economy. This one was by car, not jet, along miles of empty highway, to a town called Galesburg, 45 minutes or so from the Iowa border in western Illinois. I'd gone to meet with a group of union leaders from the Maytag plant, for the company had announced plans to lay off 1,600 employees and shift operations to Mexico. Like towns all across central and western Illinois, Galesburg had been pounded by the shift of manufacturing overseas. In the previous few years, the town had lost industrial parts makers and a rubber hose manufacturer. It was now in the process of seeing Butler Manufacturing, a steelmaker recently bought by Australians, shutter its doors. Already, Galesburg's unemployment rate hovered near 8%. With the Maytag plants closing, the town stood to lose another 5 to 10% of its entire employment base. Inside the machinists' union hall, 7 or 8 men and 2 or 3 women had gathered on metal folding chairs, talking in muted voices, a few smoking cigarettes, most of them in their late 40s or early 50s, all of them dressed in jeans or khakis, t-shirts, or plaid work shirts. The union president, Dave Bavard, explained that the union had tried every possible tactic to get Maytag to change its mind, talking to the press, contacting shareholders, soliciting support from local and state officials. The Maytag management had been unmoved. "It ain't like these guys aren't making a profit," Dave told me. "And if you ask them, they'll tell you we're one of the most productive plants in the company. Quality workmanship, low error rates. We've taken cuts in pay, cuts in benefits, layoffs. The state and the city have given Maytag at least $10 million in tax breaks over the last 8 years, based on their promise to stay. But it's never enough. Some CEO who's already making millions of dollars decides he needs to boost the company's stock price so he can cash in on his options, and the easiest way to do this is to send the work to Mexico and pay the workers there a sixth of what we make." I asked them what steps state or federal agencies had taken to retrain workers, and almost in unison, the room laughed derisively. "Retraining's a joke," the union vice president, Doug Dennison, said. "What are you going to retrain for if there aren't any jobs out there?" One of the younger men in the group told me a particularly cruel story. He had made up his mind to retrain as a computer technician, but a week into his courses, Maytag called him back. The Maytag work was temporary, but according to the rules, if this man refused to accept Maytag's offer, he'd no longer be eligible for retraining money. If, on the other hand,